when you've been around the church for a lot of years, things are very familiar, especially at Advent. The passages are from the Bible are very familiar. The shepherds are keeping and watching their flocks by night. The music is familiar. So it's hard to be surprised when you've been around for a while. You'll be surprised this morning at our reading. This isn't a passage in the scriptures we often read out loud when we go into Advent. And it's a passage that maybe you saw and skimmed over quickly, but didn't stop to read out loud, nor have anybody preach about it for quite a while. So prepare to be surprised. The book of the genealogy of Jesus Christ, the son of David, the son of Abraham. Abraham was the father of Isaac, and Isaac the father of Jacob, and Jacob the father of Judah and his brothers, and Judah the father of Perez and Sarah by Tamar, and Perez the father of Hezron, and Hezron the father of Ram, and Ram the father of Aminadab, and Aminadab the father of Nashon, and Nashon the father of Salmon. Salmon the father of Boaz by Rahab, and Boaz the father of Obed by Ruth, and Obed the father of Jesse, and Jesse the father of David the king. And David was the father of Solomon by the wife of Uriah, and Solomon the father of Rehoboam, and Rehoboam the father of Abijah, and Abijah the father of Asaph, and Asaph the father of Jehoshaphat, and Jehoshaphat the father of Joram, and Joram the father of Uzziah, and Uzziah the father of Jotham, and Jotham the father of Ahaz, and Ahaz the father of Hezekiah, and Hezekiah the father of Manasseh, and Manasseh the father of Amos, and Amos the father of Josiah, and Josiah the father of Jeconiah and his brothers at the time of the deportation to Babylon. And after the deportation to Babylon, Jeconiah was the father of Shealtiel, and Shealtiel the father of Zerubbabel, and Zerubbabel the father of Abiud, and Abiud the father of Eliakim, and Eliakim the father of Azor, and Azor the father of Zadok, and Zadok the father of Akim, and Akim the father of Eliud, and Eliud the father of Eleazar, and Eleazar the father of Matan, and Matan the father of Jacob, and Jacob the father of Joseph, the husband of Mary, of whom Jesus was born, who is called Christ. So, all the generations from Abraham to David were 14 generations, and from David to the deportation to Babylon, 14 generations, and from the deportation to Babylon to the Christ, 14 generations.
You guys are excited, right? So, it is Advent season, Christmas is coming, and as followers of Jesus, we really do believe that he is the reason for the season. But who is he? Who is Jesus? You can go a lot of different places and get a lot of different answers to that question. A faithful Muslim will tell you that Jesus was a prophet of God, in fact, the second to last and second greatest prophet after Muhammad. If you read modern historians, you will get a dizzying variety of answers. Jesus is everything from an imitation Greek philosopher to a failed revolutionary in their eyes. If you were to sort of just try and get the pulse of our culture today, you might get the impression that Jesus was a nice guy who told people to love one another and not judge. There are a lot of different answers to this question, who is Jesus? And this morning we begin studying the Gospel of Matthew, which is one of the four books in the Bible that are devoted entirely to answering that question. Who is Jesus? And Matthew apparently was not a guy who beat around the bush or pulled punches. It takes him 8 words. It's actually less than that in Greek, but 8 English words to get to his answer. The book of the genealogy of Jesus Christ. Christ is not a last name. It's a Greek translation of a Hebrew word, Messiah. And so Matthew is saying right there in the first line, Jesus is the Messiah. The Messiah was the one everyone had been waiting for. He was the great king who was going to come and restore all things. He was going to put an end to hatred and instill harmony. He was going to put an end to foolishness and instill wisdom. He was going to put an end to loneliness and instill communion. He was going to fix it all. And right off the top, Matthew says, that's who Jesus is. Jesus is the Messiah. Jesus is the one you've been waiting for. And this genealogy, the next 16 and a half verses, so ably and enthusiastically read by Mark. Thank you, Mark. I'm sure you guys were all riveted. Have it memorized now. This is Matthew starting immediately to sort of flesh out his claim that Jesus is the Messiah and to back it up. And in these verses, Matthew makes an historical point about who Jesus is, an eschatological point, yes, I will explain what that word means, about who Jesus is, and a pastoral point about who Jesus is. An historical point, an eschatological point, and a pastoral point. So the historical point is that Jesus is the real deal. Matthew wants you to understand that Jesus is the real deal. Starting this way is weird to our ears. It's not weird to ancient ears. It would have immediately clued them in. No, I'm talking about a real person. Jesus is not somebody who came falling down out of the heavens and landed in a cornfield in Iowa and suddenly discovered that our yellow sun allowed him to go faster than a speeding bullet and leap tall buildings with a single bound. That's not what's going on here. Jesus is the sort of person who cried for his mother, who played tag in the town square, who did chores, who learned to read. He is the real deal. Now, any genealogy, any sort of list of family history would have established that much. Why this specific list, this specific family history? Well, there's a couple of reasons, because there's actually a couple of lists. There's 2 genealogies here. The first one is very short. It's all in verse 1. And then verses 2 to 16 make up the second one. So the first genealogy, like I said, very short. It says, this is the book of the genealogy of Jesus Christ, the son of David, the son of Abraham. And that's the whole genealogy. And what Matthew's doing with that first genealogy is just establishing Jesus' basic credentials. It was very clear from the Jewish scriptures that if there was going to be a Messiah, he was going to come from the house of David. He was going to be one of the sons of the great King David. And so Matthew is saying Jesus has that basic requirement. And it's even more clear that he, like all of God's people in those days, was going to come from Abraham, was going to be a child of Abraham. And so Matthew is establishing that. Jesus has the sort of basic credentials to be the Messiah. He went to medical school and completed residency, so he is qualified to treat you. That's what Matthew is saying in verse 1. But then he keeps going in the second genealogy. And it is a little messier. The second genealogy is actually kind of full of the sordid details. It was enough to be David's son and Abraham's son. Why does Matthew have to establish that Jesus is also of the line of Aminadab, whoever that is, and Rehoboam, and Shealtiel, and Ahud? Why all of the details? And it's not just the level of detail. There is stuff in here that none of us would willingly put in our family history. Look at verse 10. And Hezekiah, the father of Manasseh, and Manasseh, the father of Amos, and Amos, the father of Josiah. Let's talk about Manasseh for just a moment. Manasseh was a king of Israel, and in the history of a lot of bad kings, Manasseh took the cake. One of his acts was to take his own child and burn him alive as an offering to another god. And Matthew could have not included Manasseh. By the rules of genealogies in those days, you can skip generations. The father of can actually mean the great-great-great-great-great-great-grandfather of. And that's no problem. You can't make anything up, but you can leave stuff out. That's why son of David, son of Abraham is enough. But Matthew decides to include Manasseh. And lots of other nasty people. I'm not going to give you all of the details. Read the Old Testament. But he decides to include Manasseh. Not only that, Matthew makes a highly unusual choice to include women. By the rules of Jewish genealogy, you did not need to do that. It was actually pretty weird if you did. And Matthew does, knowing that it will draw our attention, and it will particularly draw ancient readers' attention. What are these women doing in here? Why is Tamar included? Why Rahab? And all of these women, there are five of them, all of them are scandalous in one way or another. Four out of the five are foreigners. That wasn't supposed to happen. One of them is a professional prostitute. One of them just happens to be prostituting herself when she produces the next person in the line. And in one case, Matthew goes out of his way to draw attention to the scandal. So if you look at verse 6, and Jesse, the father of David the king, and David was the father of Solomon by the wife of Uriah. She has a name, we know it, it's Bathsheba. Matthew could have just said Bathsheba, or he could have, you know, not included her at all. But he chooses to say the wife of Uriah and make us all remember, particularly make ancient Jewish readers remember, that David, one of the heroes of this story, did not produce Solomon, the next in line, by his first wife, Michal, or his second wife, Abigail, or any of his other wives, but instead saw a woman, Bathsheba, who was married to someone else, said, I've got to have her, claimed her, committed adultery, got her pregnant, and then killed Uriah to cover it up. Matthew is drawing attention to this. He is not telling the kind of family history we like to tell when we're around the Thanksgiving dinner table. He is making us pay attention to the worst parts of Jesus' family history. Why would he do that? Why not just stop at son of David, son of Abraham? Because Matthew wants us to know that Jesus is the real deal. He wants us to know how committed he is to telling us the real story of a real person. Jesus was an actual figure in history with an actual family history, and Matthew is not going to do anything to whitewash that, to cover up anything or accentuate anything. He is going to do everything he can to tell the story as it is. And that's Matthew's historical point here. If Jesus is the real deal, then deal with the reality of Jesus. If Jesus is the real deal, then deal with the reality of Jesus. In other words, don't customize Jesus. In our home, we have this weird space where we used to have a dining room table, but we've moved it out, and there's not really anything there. And Vanessa and I have been talking about what to do. What combination of cabinets and shelves or work table or desks should go there. And once we decide exactly what we want, we will either acquire or build those exact things and put them there. We will customize it to fit that space in our home. And we are used to thinking about things that way, and we often think about Jesus that way, as something that we can customize to our preferences and then insert him into our existing lives. So we take a favorite teaching of Jesus or story about Jesus and make that all there is to know about Jesus. Or we take a least favorite story or teaching of Jesus and just kind of, I don't know what to do with that over here. We take a favorite moment. We just take the cross. Jesus died for my sins. I'm paid for it, not guilty. That's the good news. End of story. See, we've customized Jesus down from the real deal to something that fits conveniently in our already existing lives. And the challenge that Matthew is issuing is not to do that, but to deal with the full reality of Jesus. The parts that captivate our hearts and lift us up, and the parts that cut us off at the knees. If Jesus is the real deal, deal with the reality of Jesus. That's Matthew's historical point, that Jesus is a real part of history. But Matthew's not stopping there. He's not saying that Jesus is a real part of history. He's saying that Jesus is the entire point of history. If you were to imagine the true history of the entire world written out in 10,000 pages, right? None of us get in. There's no footnote on page 734 that has Donna's name on it, right? We just don't make it, right? We know some people who get footnotes, right? You know, Joan of Arc or Marco Polo or probably most presidents. There's even some people who get whole sections, right? Muhammad probably merits an entire section, or somebody like Alexander the Great. The true history of the world would begin with Jesus and end with Jesus and have Jesus' name on every single page. He is the point. He is the main character and the resolution. Jesus is the end of the story. And by end, I mean both last, as in the last chapter of a book is the end, and by end, I mean goal or purpose, as in the end of us being here right now is to worship Jesus. And that's Matthew's eschatological point. Eschatological is just a big fancy theology word for the end. Things having to do with the end. And biblical eschatology is really one word long. Jesus. That's the whole thing. He is the end of the story. And Matthew is showing us this in his genealogy. All right, so in verse 1, he highlights two people out of the whole story of Israel. He calls Jesus the son of David and the son of Abraham, and that's not an accident, because every ancient Jew would have known that David and Abraham were the recipients of the two greatest unfulfilled, unfinished promises in the history of God's people. And by highlighting them and calling Jesus their son, Matthew is saying Jesus is the fulfillment of both of those promises. So God makes a promise to King David in 2 Samuel chapter 7. In 2 Samuel chapter 7, verses 12 and 13. This is what God says to David. When your days are fulfilled and you lie down with your fathers, when you die, I will raise up your offspring after you, who shall come from your body, and I will establish his kingdom. He shall build a house for my name, and I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever. You're king, you're the king I chose, but you're going to die. Your reign's going to end. But there is going to come from you a king whose reign does not end. And immediately after David heard this prophecy, and for several years afterward, everyone thought that Solomon, David's son, was the answer. Solomon built a temple, a house for God, and he reigned over the greatest extent that God's people ever achieved. But then Solomon died, and the temple that he built was destroyed. And the promise was unfulfilled. The story was not ended. And when Matthew says Jesus is not just a son of David, but the son of David, he is saying Jesus is the end of the David story. Jesus is the true king who will build a house for God. The house for God, the temple, was supposed to be God's physical presence on earth. And Jesus comes as God incarnate, as the true temple, and builds a house for God on earth. And even though Jesus goes to the cross and dies to pay for our sins, that temple, that house, is not ultimately destroyed, for Jesus rises from the grave and lives forevermore. Matthew is crying out, Jesus is the end of the David story. Jesus is the king you've actually been looking for, the one who will reign with wisdom and justice and perfect love forever and ever. Jesus isn't just a part of the story, he's the end of the story. And then Matthew backs even further up and says Jesus isn't just the son of David, he's the son of Abraham as well. And Abraham also received an unfinished promise from God in Genesis 12, verses 1, 2, and 3. Now the Lord said to Abram, that's Abraham, go from your country and your kindred and your father's house to the land that I will show you. And I will make of you a great nation, and I will bless you and make your name great, so that you will be a blessing. And I will bless those who bless you, and the one who dishonors you I will curse. And in you all the families of the earth will be blessed. That's the very beginning of Abraham's story in the book of Genesis. And as you read, you more and more start to believe that Isaac, Abraham's son, who finally arrives, is the answer to this promise. But Abraham dies and Isaac lives and dies, and this hasn't come true. There is no great nation. There is no blessing of all the families of the earth. And all of Israel's history happens, and God's people grow, and Abraham's family multiply, and there are times when things are wonderful, and there are times when things are terrible, but at no point does this promise get fulfilled. The point at which Abraham's children are most able to fulfill this promise is actually during the reign of Solomon. But they spend just as much time enslaving and exploiting all the families of the earth as they do blessing them. This promise goes unfulfilled, Matthew says, until Jesus. Jesus is the true end of the Abraham story. Because Jesus is the one who takes the curse that God spoke of in the promise to Abraham on himself, and instead of returning curse to you and I and all the families of the earth, seeks to bless every last one of us. In Jesus, Abraham's story is brought to an end. Abraham is the very beginning of the story for God's people. Matthew is saying that from the start, from Abraham, this has all been pointing to Jesus. Matthew, even the very structure of the genealogy, is intended to say Jesus is the end of the story. So that part in verse 17. So all the generations from Abraham to David were 14 generations, and from David to the deportation to Babylon, 14 generations, and from the deportation to Babylon to the Christ, 14 generations. Now, that may not mean much to you and I, but to people steeped in the Hebrew Bible, there are alarm bells going off. Because 14 is two sevens. And seven is the number of perfection, of completion, of something being finished. And I told you, you're allowed to skip generations in a genealogy. And Matthew has, right? He gets from 400 years before Moses to 400 years after Moses in about six generations. There's some skipping happening in there. There's some great, great, great grandfathers in the fathers. And he does that so that he can say 14, 14, 14. So that he can say there have been six sevens. Which should make you go, but where is the seventh seven? Where is the perfection of perfections? Where is the finishing of all finishing? Where is the end of the end? And it should leave you hanging and looking to Jesus to be the end of the story. Matthew's eschatological point, his point about the end, is that Jesus is the end of the story. Which means make him the end of your story. If Jesus is the end of the story, the great story, then make him the end of your story. Don't marginalize Jesus. Don't compartmentalize him. Don't set him aside. Don't come here for 90 minutes and then go to a Bible study for 90 minutes. And the other 165 hours of the week, focus on real life. On things like getting the dishes done and putting the kids to bed, studying for exams, and balancing the checkbook. Jesus is the end of the entire story. Let him be the end of your entire story. Let him be the point and purpose, not just of 10 a.m. on Sundays, but every moment of every day, forever. If Jesus is the end of the story, let him be the end of your story. that brings us to Matthew's pastoral point. Matthew knows that he's been begging the question. If Jesus is the end of the story, if he's the one we've all been waiting for, and he came, why are we still waiting? What is going on here? Remember that Matthew is writing 20, 30, 40 years after Jesus lived and died and rose from the grave and ascended into heaven. And God's people are still suffering, are still confused, are still waiting. If Jesus is the one we were supposed to wait for, and he came, then what are we doing? That's the pastoral question. And Matthew is not just a scholar, he's a pastor, a part of a church. And he wants to answer that for us. The clue that Matthew is concerned about this is in the third piece of Israel's history that he puts with David and Abraham. David and Abraham, everybody knows, were high points. The exciting stuff. The part of the history you want to make a movie about. But he highlights a third part. The deportation to Babylon. Did you see that? That was the only event that got a mention. It wasn't just somebody's name. And he repeats it in verse 17 when he's summarizing. So all the generations from Abraham to David were 14 generations, and from David to the deportation to Babylon, 14 generations, and from the deportation to Babylon to Christ, 14 generations. The deportation to Babylon was the period of greatest confusion and waiting in Israel's history. They had been kicked out of the promised land. They did not know what God was doing. They had seen God withdraw himself from the house that had been built for him, from Solomon's house. Seeing God's presence return to the heavens, and they were lost and waiting for something to happen. And they had thought that the deportation, the exile, would only last 70 years, but when Jesus comes nearly 600 years later, it's still going on. Some of God's people have trickled back into the promised land, but the presence of God has not returned. And so they find themselves waiting. And they find themselves asking this question. Waiting is miserable, right? It's hard and it's boring and it takes forever, but it's more than that, because we're not talking about the kind of waiting that my children are enduring leading up to presents on the 25th. They, when I tell them there's 23 days till Christmas right now, they translate that into 23 million years. Okay? But they know the 25th is coming. They know the exact time when the presents arrive. And that's not the kind of waiting we're enduring. Ours is a different kind. We've heard from reliable sources from Jesus himself that the wait is going to come to an end, but we have no idea when. When I was in middle school, I went to a school across town, and both my parents were working at this point, so they decided that I could catch the city bus to campus and walk to Dad's office, and that would be the way that I got home in the afternoons. And school got out, I remember this vividly, at 2:55, and the bus was supposed to come at 3:09. 14 minutes, right? And so the first time that I'm supposed to do this, I get out of class and I run from algebra class to the bus stop to make sure that I'm there, and then I sit down and I wait. And it was boring, but much more than that, it was scary, because I really did not know what was going to happen. Right? Even though I should have known, I didn't know, city buses are never early. I'm certain that the bus has already come and gone, that I've missed it, I'm going to have to go back in and ask the secretary, whose name I don't even know if I can use the phone, and try and get through to Dad and figure something out. Right? But then I'm sitting there, and 3:09 comes and goes. And 3:10, and 11, and 12, and 15, and 20. And again, I don't know. Like, this is totally normal for the city bus to be 15 minutes late. I'm losing my mind, because everything, the very fabric of reality, has fallen apart, and what am I going to do? Our waiting is like that. Because we have no idea when it comes to an end. And Matthew, in his very genealogy, is acknowledging that and reminding us that it is normal for God's people to wait, that waiting is what God's people do. He connects Jesus to Abraham. Abraham was a man of waiting. He's 75 years old. God comes to him, gives that grand promise about all the families of the earth, and 25 years later, he has a son. 25 years of waiting. And then he lives a while longer, and still there's no great nation. He dies still waiting. David does a little bit better than Abraham. He gets the promise when he's a young boy, maybe 10 or 11, that he's going to become king. And then it's only about 30 years of waiting, a good chunk of which he spends on the run for his life from the current king. But he does actually get to become king before he dies and discover that what he was waiting for was really not all it's cracked up to be. Being king does not go well for David. And then he dies, still waiting for the fulfillment of the kingdom. And God's people go into exile in 586 BC, and Jesus shows up hundreds and hundreds of years later, and they are still there, still waiting. That's like for us if the Great Depression started before Columbus sailed the ocean blue and it was still going on. Waiting is what God's people do. But Jesus is worth the wait. Jesus is worth the wait. Jesus is worth the wait because he experiences the wait himself. He knows what patience is. Abraham came and expected to lead a great people that would spread out all over the world, and he died with just a few children. Jesus came, and crowds gathered around him, and revolutions tried to start, and it seemed that he was going to turn the world upside down in a few years. And then when he died, he had a few dozen followers hiding behind locked doors. David came and was anointed king and thought, now, here it is, I get to establish the kingdom. And then his very kingship was marked by failures, by wars, by rebellions from his own children, divisions in his own household. And he never got to see the kingdom come on earth. Jesus came as King of kings and Lord of lords and lived on the run from the leaders of his own people with no place to lay his head. Jesus knows waiting. For 600 years, God's people lived in exile, removed from his presence, waiting for him to return. On the cross, for your sake and mine, Jesus endured exile. The Father turned his face away. Jesus is worth the wait because he knows waiting. And Jesus is worth the wait because he is patient with us. Because he is patient with us. You know that whole sordid family history in verses 2 to 16? All those screw-ups, all those sinners? You realize it's not actually Jesus' family history, right? You see that in verse 16. And Jacob, the father of Joseph, the husband of Mary, of whom Jesus was born. Not the father of Jesus. This family's problems are not actually Jesus' family's problems until he comes and makes them his problems. Until he comes and makes you his problem and makes himself your solution. Jesus is worth the wait because he has been patient with you. He has endured all of your failures, all of your shortcomings, and still chosen to make you a part of his family. So listen, brothers and sisters, be patient. Be patient. Accept the waiting. Endure the waiting. Be patient in the waiting. Do not be like a farmer who goes out in the spring, plows his field, plants seed, goes home, and prays a great prayer and speaks a word of faith over his field, goes back out there the next morning, sees that nothing has happened, and then declares, God is not at work. The harvest is not coming. Nothing happened. What is God doing? No. Be like a farmer who goes out into his field, plows, plants, goes home and prays, comes back the next day and waters, comes back the next day and waters again, comes back the next day and weeds, comes back the next day and tends, comes back the next day and, don't tell the people in Corvallis I said this, sprays for bugs. Be patient. Jesus is the end of the story. Jesus is worth waiting for, but Jesus is not in a hurry. He is not rushing. He does not have your timetable. You might be right square in the middle of the lineage of Jesus, and your name is Amminadab, and you are the father of Nahshon, and your lot is to live and die in Egypt in bondage. And Jesus will still be worth the wait. If you find yourself struggling with the same sins over and over again, with the same frustrating relationship over and over again, with the same infuriating circumstances in life over and over again, be patient. Jesus is worth the wait, but Jesus is not in a hurry. When we were interviewing and considering coming here to Calvin, we spent an afternoon with Pastor Mark and Carol. And Mark told me that in his last year or two of ministry here at Calvin, God had told him he was a foundation finisher. And he seemed to think that was really sweet of God. I thought it was kind of cheeky of God. I would have thought, in Mark's case, really? 25 years? A foundation finisher? Who builds a house and spends 25 years on the foundation? That's too long. But God is not in a hurry. Be patient. And you know what else I thought? Because this is just how arrogant I am. I thought, sweet, now I get to build the house. Thanks, Mark. Maybe. Or maybe I get to spend 35 years framing two walls on the ground floor. Or maybe 35 years and we get 3/4 of the way down and then a fire comes through and burns it all down so the next guy can start fresh. Jesus is worth the wait, but he is not in a hurry. For all I know, Jesus is working and plotting and sowing seed and plowing and tending Calvin so that there can be a revival here in the year 2300. And our grandchildren's grandchildren's grandchildren can experience it. And for all I know, Jesus is coming back tomorrow. Either way, he will be worth the wait. Regardless of where you are, in the middle of a fruitful harvest or staring at an empty field in which it appears that nothing will ever grow, Jesus is with you. He has chosen to make you a part of his family, and he is worth the wait. Brothers and sisters, be patient. Let's pray. Lord, help us. We are not good at waiting. We want to seize the day, to make something happen, to see little seeds grow up into mature trees in a matter of days over the course of an afternoon. Help us to remember that you are worth the wait. That the story may be long and dark and difficult, and we may not be able to read ahead, but you have entered the story, and you are the end of the story. Help us to patiently put our trust in you. Help us to know that you are worth it. Help us, Jesus. Amen.